From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Arlington, Virginia.
I'm Celeste Headlee in Bethesda, Maryland. It's Here and Now. People are experiencing a mix of emotions after a judge struck down the federal mask mandate on domestic flights and public transit in the U.S. Happiness, concern, confusion, perhaps one of those words describes how you feel. The Biden administration plans to appeal the ruling if the CDC decides there's a public health need for a mandate. Until then, it's up to individual passengers to decide whether to mask up or not. So let's talk about planes, masks, and safety with Dr. William Schaffner, a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Welcome back.
Good to be with you.
So what do you make of this ruling that lifts the mask mandate on planes and other public transportation?
Well, it seems to have accelerated perhaps CDC's timeline a little bit. And according to the news reports, it was welcomed by many, many passengers. But I do have a caution. I think some people will continue to wear the mask quite appropriately. Those who are older and frail, those with underlying illnesses such as heart disease, lung disease, diabetes is so common, and anyone who's immune compromised, and even those people who care for persons in this high-risk group. Those folks, I think, would be well advised to continue to wear the mask.
Although, I mean, on my own account, even though I'm vaccinated and boosted, I still don't want to get COVID. I am seeing stories of those who get long COVID and other complications. And one way or the other, if I can avoid it, I would rather not get it.
Well, good for you, Celeste, because I think that that's an important consideration. Some people are more risk-averse. You and I, we're going to continue to be careful because we respect this virus. It's a nasty virus. Don't wish to become ill either acutely or develop long COVID, and we don't want to give it to anyone else.
Yep. So in December, a number of experts, including you, suggested that the contagiousness of Omicron might mean that traveling by air was more risky than before. Do we know whether that is still the case?
I don't think we have very good data on that. I will say that the larger planes do have a very, very controlled method of dealing with their air handling. It goes through a filtration system, and it's very localized throughout the plane. It's like slices of bread in a loaf. If you're in coach, you won't be exposed to the air that's in first class and vice versa. So I think although the risk is low, I think nonetheless, being so close to so many people indoors does carry a risk. You don't know that the virus is not traveling with you.
And do we know whether that air filtration system is enough? Many of them completely replace the air inside the cabin every 3 minutes on average. Is that enough to protect you now that masks are optional?
If you're looking for complete safety, I think that's a vain hope. But it does reduce the risk very, very substantially.
So there's a lot of uncertainty right now, as I mentioned. A lot of people are confused. Guidance changes frequently. It has for the past 2 years. It's often contradictory. A federal agency might be doing one thing, while a state agency or local agency might be doing another. So how do you suggest people calculate risk?
Well, I think much has to do with who they are, first off. Are they risk-averse or are they more apt to accept risk? And then, very importantly, are you a member of one of these high-risk groups? That's very important.
Is it reasonable to expect we will see a rise in cases now that masks are optional on public transportation?
Well, I think there will be a rise in cases. There isn't any doubt. How much public transport contributes to that, we don't know. You know, this Omicron variant, BA2, is so highly contagious, it's even capable of infecting people who are well vaccinated. But in those folks, it will produce a cold-like syndrome. It won't require hospitalization, and that's what the vaccines do. They protect us against severe disease and hospitalization. So we may well see cases, but I do not think we will have a major surge of hospitalizations and a new major stress on the healthcare system.
Dr. William Schaffner is a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University School of Medicine. Doctor, as always, thank you so much for your clarity.
A great pleasure.
In Georgia, a group of voters wants to disqualify a controversial Republican congresswoman from running again. We are talking about Marjorie Taylor Greene. She is expected to testify in a court case that starts on Friday. And the group challenging argues Greene was involved in the January 6th riots at the Capitol and thus should not be allowed on the ballot. Here is Greene's response.
I don't care what the lawsuit says. I did nothing wrong. And this is a scam.
Reporter Sam Greenglass is covering this for member station WABE in Georgia. Sam, welcome.
Hi, Scott.
Marjorie Taylor Greene has been controversial since she was elected in 2020. She has amplified far-right and conspiracy theories. What is she being accused of doing on January 6th?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, even before she came to Congress, she has this history of using violent rhetoric against her political opponents. She's been one of the most vocal spreaders of false claims about the 2020 election. This candidacy challenge points to a couple specific moments, though. One is a tweet that she sent on January 5th, 2021, the day before the riot, where she called January 6th our 1776 moment. Another is a Facebook video where Greene said, "You can't allow it to just transfer power peacefully." Greene has pretty forcefully, as you heard in that tape at the top of the segment, criticized the premise of this challenge. She says she's never encouraged political violence and that she never will. She says this whole challenge to her candidacy is just politically motivated.
Yeah. Now, the group challenging her is called Free Speech for the People. And here is some tape from the group's legal director, Rob Fine.
Marjorie Taylor Greene fomented an insurrection on January 6th. She's a danger in office to the entire republic.
So what is the legal lever this group is trying to pull here to take Representative Greene's name off the ballot?
Yeah, so Free Speech, Free People is leaning on two things, really. One is a provision in Georgia law that allows voters to challenge a candidate's qualifications for office. So there's this process that's laid out if a voter wants to go ahead and say, "I don't think this person should be legally qualified to run." The other is a clause in the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, and it says that no member of Congress who participated in an insurrection should be qualified to serve. Little history lesson, this is a measure that was added in the years after the Civil War to prevent former Confederates from serving in Congress. But there's actually not a lot of precedent for testing this claim in modern U.S. history because there hasn't really been any insurrections until January 6th. So now that Judge Totenberg has ruled that this challenge can move ahead, there's this administrative law judge hearing on Friday. They'll make a recommendation of what should happen next, and then it's up to the Secretary of State for Georgia to make a decision about whether she should be on the ballot.
Okay. Now, is there a counterargument in Georgia that is, you know, if you erase someone's name from the ballot, this is bad news for democracy. You know, we should let the voters choose.
Yeah, and so, you know, I talked to a trial attorney here, Paige Pate, and one of the things that he said is a consequence of this kind of litigation is that this could kind of create a new frontier where you've got people filing lawsuits all the time saying that their political opponents aren't fit to run for office. You know, we're in this moment where elections more broadly have become increasingly litigious over everything from vote counts to how elections are conducted, and this could be one new piece of that. Now, I will say that, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene, in trying to get this challenge thrown out, said that this infringes on her First Amendment rights and due process rights. But Judge Totenberg, when considering that challenge to the challenge, basically said, look, there's no fundamental constitutional right to appear on a ballot. So that claim is just not valid.
Okay. And this is the federal judge who said, yes, this case can continue. Yeah, the state case can continue. Okay. Now, you mentioned Georgia attorney Paige Pate. You have a little piece of tape that we're going to introduce her here. Paige Pate says just getting Green to testify may be part of the strategy here. Let's listen.
They want to have her questioned under oath. Number one, to find out what involvement, if any, she had in this insurrection. And number two, if she makes any false statement, she could be charged with perjury or perhaps some other crime.
So very quickly, Sam, if Marjorie Taylor Greene indeed testifies, how big a moment would that be?
Yeah, so first, it's actually not clear whether she's going to testify at all on Friday, but this case is almost certainly to be appealed. Then it could end up in a quote-unquote real court, a superior court, eventually the state Supreme Court, and then she may, you know, have to testify under oath. And of course, the public, members of Congress, her constituents, prosecutors will be very interested in what she has to say.
All right, Sam Greenglass, reporter for WABE in Georgia. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
China has vowed to stick to its zero-tolerance COVID policy as it contends with rising cases and strict lockdowns in Shanghai and other cities. And that policy requires hiring tens of thousands of workers to test, isolate, and lock down cities. So where are those workers coming from, and what are they going through? NPR's Emily Feng reports on China's new COVID cast.
Like millions of migrant workers before him, 20-year-old Chen Haonan decided the southern city of Shenzhen was where he would make his fortune. He moved down there hoping to cash in on a decades-long real estate boom by becoming a property salesman. But an economic downturn and strict controls on the property sector put him out of that job last year.
Then the pandemic came and all our real estate projects were stopped.
So, jobless, Chen found work through a temp hiring agency in the only sector really growing these days in China, COVID control. Enforcing the latest lockdowns, manning dozens of state isolation wards, and running mass testing campaigns. His last job was a months-long stint testing residents during Shenzhen's lockdown late last year. Now Shanghai is in total lockdown, so he was sent to staff Shanghai's National Exhibition and Convention Center. It's been turned into a state isolation ward for 15,000 feverish people, and he's shocked by the conditions there.
I am most worried that I cannot guarantee my own health. There are other workers who are COVID positive, but we sleep next to them in a trailer. They've simply been reassigned to work as guards or trash pickers for the expo center rather than tending to people inside.
There's also no running water or drinking water in his dorm. His manager told him to drink from a nearby river when Chen asked for bottled water. Last week, his self-test showed he was positive for COVID. He has a scratchy throat, but instead of resting, he's had to keep on working because he's not allowed to leave the center.
The leaders are not very responsible. They react very slowly to our needs.
For decades, China's economy has relied on an itinerant class of what Chinese policymakers call its floating population, some 300 million migrant workers who drift from city to city doing construction work, service jobs, and factory assembly, often in poor conditions. An economic slowdown and more regulations means many of those sectors are shrinking. So labor agencies have been heavily recruiting now underemployed migrant workers to fill a new niche for cheap labor. COVID prevention. Worker Lu Weishui says it's thankless work done by non-locals.
All cities are the same. Shanghai, Wuhan. The vast majority look down on outsiders, migrant workers like me.
Lu calls himself a professional COVID worker. He lost his job at a metal supply shop during the pandemic, so he turned to COVID prevention in Shenzhen. He gets paid about $100 a day, working six-hour shifts twice a day.
The outbreak in Shenzhen is mostly controlled, so they'll start firing workers. I got a group of buddies together, and we'll look for the next lockdown for more work.
When Shanghai got locked down, Lu said he'd go help scan buildings, or sao lo, slang for going door to door, convincing unwilling residents to take a PCR test. Except this time, Lu didn't make it to Shanghai. He got off the bus halfway after the temp agency tried to claim most of his salary as a finder's fee.
We were tricked by a corrupt labor agent. I managed to get on another bus headed to a nearby city where there's been an outbreak linked to Shanghai's. So now I'm going house to house, knocking on doors and doing PCR tests there.
The same thing happened to Huang Bowen. He lost his job as an e-commerce marketer when tough new rules came into effect last year on online marketing. He agreed to a job administering PCR tests in Shanghai this month, taking a 20-hour bus ride to the city under lockdown.
Except the bus brought us straight to a quarantine center for symptomatic patients. That's not the kind of work we'd been promised. All of us workers did not dare enter without proper health training. But since we'd been in Shanghai, we couldn't just get on a bus back home. We'd been quarantined as soon as we got back.
After calling the police, Huang did make it home. He's in quarantine now, and he's now planning to live with his parents after, until he can find better work. Migrant Li Ke was already living in Shanghai when the city shut down. He's now wrapped up in PPE and working in a school turned into a makeshift quarantine facility, sleeping 10 to a room with other workers. But that's better than what his fellow migrant workers are going through.
I consider myself lucky. I got out of my workers' dormitory in Shanghai before lockdown, so at least I can earn some money and pay the rent.
Li Ke may feel lucky, but the work he's doing carries extreme stigma. Because of China's ongoing strict pandemic controls, anyone associated with COVID prevention work literally becomes untouchable. After weeks on the job, they need to be kept apart and quarantined from the rest of the population for at least 2 weeks.
Even though national policy is only 2 weeks, authorities insist in keeping me in here for 4 weeks of quarantine.
This is Shi Wantian, who volunteered to work in a state quarantine center during an outbreak this year in the northern city of Langfang, not far from Beijing. Except he contracted COVID in the first week. He was not allowed to isolate in the very ward he was working in. Instead, he's being held in an off-the-grid facility, little more than a metal box with windows.
I used to work at a factory for car parts, but during the lockdown, my work stopped, so I volunteered to staff at the isolation facility. Now the lockdown is over, but here I am in this state.
15 years ago, these were the workers assembling phones in Chinese factories, building skyscrapers, and fixing cars. Today, they're among the ranks of the Dabai, or Big Whites, as China calls them, the ubiquitous COVID workers clothed in white protective gear. Anonymous yet essential. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
Here in the U.S., if you're trying to buy a house this spring, you might face some stiff headwinds. The National Association of Realtors said today that the median home price hit a new record in March, $375,000. And there's also a record low supply of new houses to buy. NPR's Scott Horsley has been looking at all of this. Scott, hello.
Good to be with you.
Let's start with the home prices. The median home price hitting $375,000. How is that happening?
Home prices have jumped 15% in the last year, and that just speaks to the really hot demand, although maybe not quite as hot as it had been. Sales of existing homes were actually down a bit in March for the second month in a row, down 2.7% from February. And down about 4.5% from this time last year. But there are still a lot of people who want to buy houses. And as you mentioned, there just are not a lot of houses for sale on the market. Right now, there's about a two-month supply of existing homes. That's up just a little bit from February. And almost all are selling quickly. Nearly 9 out of 10 homes sold last month were sold in less than a month.
So interest rates for new loans are also way up, 5% last week on average. How is that affecting the market?
Yeah, that 5% average on a 30-year fixed mortgage, according to Freddie Mac, is up. It's still low by historical standards, but it's up a lot from just over 3% from a year ago. And for that median-priced home, if you were to finance it, that rise in interest rates means your monthly mortgage payment is going to be about $340 higher than it would have been a year earlier. That's just because of the rising interest rate. That's on top of the price increase we've been talking about. So, yeah, a lot of would-be buyers are finding themselves priced out of this housing market, and that's only going to get worse as interest rates are expected to keep climbing. Now, at some point, that jump in interest rates will start to put some downward pressure on prices, but we're not seeing that yet. And one reason is that there are a lot of cash buyers out there, investors and others who don't need to get a mortgage. Cash buyers accounted for 28% of existing home sales in March, and that's the largest proportion in 8 years.
And then we add one more wrinkle here, which is that there's not a lot of houses available to buy. The Commerce Department reported this week that housing starts, that's new residential construction, is up 0.3%, or at least it was last month. That doesn't sound like a lot, but just any increase was a surprise here. What trends are you seeing?
Yeah, but all of that increase in March was in multifamily homes, apartment buildings, that sort of thing. If you look just at single-family home construction, that was down in March. And the pattern with housing permits, which are sort of an indicator of what's on the horizon, tell a similar story. Permits for apartment buildings were up in March, but permits for single-family homes were down by almost 5%. Now, builders do have a lot of new houses in the pipeline, but they're taking longer than usual to finish. Home builders, like just about any other kind of business, are being affected by shortages of labor and lumber and all sorts of other materials.
Can you read the tea leaves on what it means that builders are more interested in building apartments than single-family homes?
Well, they're still building more single-family homes. That still makes up the lion's share of the market, about two-thirds of housing starts last month and more than 60% of permits. But the ratio is not quite as lopsided in favor of single-family homes as it used to be. They are building more apartments now than they do typically. And that speaks to probably more demand for apartments and other kinds of multifamily units, either because of lifestyle choices or, more likely, affordability.
So I hate to do this to you with only 30 seconds left, but is it possible there's a bubble brewing here in the housing market?
Well, housing is one of the sectors that's most sensitive to interest rates. So as the Federal Reserve pushes rates up in its effort to get control over inflation, we would expect to see some drop in demand for houses and maybe some adjustments in price. That might not be an absolute drop in prices, but at least a slowdown in the double-digit housing inflation we have been seeing. That said, we're starting from a pretty warm spot, so there's a lot of room to cool off before you start to feel any sort of real chill.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
August Wilson was one of the greatest playwrights of 20th century American theater. He used his work to chronicle the pain, triumph, and resilience of Black life. Now a new expansive exhibit celebrates Wilson's legacy in his hometown of Pittsburgh. WESA's Bill O'Driscoll reports.
The first thing you see in August Wilson, the writer's landscape, looks like an old school neighborhood diner. There's an upholstered booth, a lunch counter, even cigarette ash in a half-empty coffee cup. If that seems an odd tribute to a world-famous playwright, well, the late August Wilson often wrote in diners. And this exhibit was curated by his wife, Constanza Romero Wilson.
It was important for me for people to see that he was a real person. He was a real Pittsburgher.
Wilson was born in Pittsburgh in 1945 and won fame only after leaving town for good in 1978. But Romero Wilson says the city made him who he was.
He grew up observing the people here. Hearing the way they speak, their tonality, their musicality. So the spirit of Pittsburghers lives in all of August's plays.
There's nothing in American theater quite like Wilson's monumental century cycle. It's 10 plays, each depicting Black life in a different decade of the 20th century, mostly through working class characters like blues musicians and jitney cab drivers. All 10 made it to Broadway. Fences and the Piano Lesson won Pulitzer Prizes. And a Broadway theater was named after him in 2005 after his death, the first named after a Black person. 4 years later, the August Wilson African American Cultural Center opened in a grand new building in downtown Pittsburgh, just half a mile from the brick row house where Wilson lived as a child. Executive Director Janice Burley Wilson says this is the largest permanent exhibit about Wilson anywhere.
It was important to definitely have a site where people could walk and be immersed in August Wilson's work, learn about his influences, learn about how he worked and why he did the things that he did.
A replica of Wilson's home office in Seattle features his writing desk and personal effects like books and records. Interactive video honors his influences, like the Black Power movement. Here's archival audio of Wilson himself discussing blues music.
I think the blues is the best literature that we have, blacks have created since we've been here, and it's a lot of philosophical ideas, and I call it our sacred book.
The walkthrough installations focus on each of his century cycle plays. The rooms are like small stage sets, from the piano lessons wallpapered parlor to the brick-walled backyard of seven guitars. Short videos provide the historical context and plot for each play. Here's Denzel Washington and Viola Davis in 2017's big screen adaptation of Fences.
It's not easy for me to admit that I've been standing in the same place for 18 years.
Well, I've been standing with you. I've been right here with you, Troy. I got a life too.
Wilson dramatized not only the daily struggle for love and survival, but also the importance of black culture and history. Ruben Santiago Hudson directed and acted in numerous Wilson productions on and off Broadway. He also contributed to the new exhibit, which he says brings home Wilson's real artistic victory, the idea that black lives matter on stage.
Instead of black life being on the periphery, he put it in the center of what is Americana. He was huge in his ideas and his thoughts in creating a space for us. So we didn't need permission to be a part of America. With August Wilson, we are America.
Admission to August Wilson, The Writer's Landscape, is free to all. For NPR, I'm Bill O'Driscoll in Pittsburgh.
Ukrainian and Russian forces are fighting in eastern Ukraine as Russia steps up its offensive to capture the region. And Ukrainian fighters are refusing to surrender in Mariupol, which has been under siege for weeks. So let's look at Russia's strategy and how its concentrated efforts in the east may unfold. We have on the line Jeffrey Edmonds, a Russian military analyst at CNA, a think tank. He's worked at the White House and the CIA. Jeffrey, welcome back.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Ukrainian President Zelensky has said the battle for the Donbas has begun, the eastern part of Ukraine. And yet the Pentagon is telling us they're seeing limited offensive operations so far in that area by Russia. So how do we square that?
So I think what we might be seeing is preparatory actions on the part of the Russians. They've had to draw units from Belarus, from other parts of Ukraine, and from Russia itself in order to build up enough combat power for what they think they need to conduct offensive operations. One reason we may not be seeing a very aggressive front from the Russians is that they've really taken on a lot of casualties. And so they're having to cobble together a force that's been pretty beat up.
Do you anticipate that after this buildup, we will see significant moves by the Russian army?
I think we're going to see the Russians try to take the remainder of those oblasts, which are kind of like provinces. I think they're focusing on that because that's all they can do to try to pull some kind of semblance of victory out of this that they can sell to the Russian people. So I think we're going to see that. The real question is, how concerted is that going to be? How strong is it going to be? And are they actually going to be able to do it?
And let's say they do succeed. How would that fit into the broader Russian strategy here in Ukraine?
Well, I think what it would signify is that the Russians had succeeded in their revised strategy, right? This was clearly not their plan from the beginning, even though they claimed that it was. It was very clear from the beginning that the plan was to seize Kyiv and Kharkiv and some other major cities with the belief that the resistance, the Ukrainian military, would just fall away. That clearly was not the case. They were unable to do that. And this is an attempt to kind of salvage something from their entire operation in Ukraine.
And then would it be a possibility that they can somehow declare victory and then this starts to fade a little bit? I mean, is that a potential move toward an end game here?
I think it is. I think that the most the Russians can hope for right now and what they're trying to do is to take control of Luhansk and Donetsk, go home, declare victory, and that's the end of it. And in a sense, we have something that's very similar to what we had before all this started.
Right, the 8 years of fighting that led up to this. I think last time we spoke to you, we mentioned Russian troops having had notable problems. Supply lines, food, fuel. You mentioned they've struggled to take key cities. Mariupol has held on for a long time. Does it seem to you that Russian military leaders have learned and are adapting?
So I think adapting is giving them a lot. I think what they're having to do is, again, try to salvage this. It's not as if they've adapted and decided to take on a new military objective. It's that this is all they can do at this point because they've taken so many casualties and because, you know, the war has gone so poorly for them so far.
Yeah. You know, on this show, we've also talked about Vladimir Putin's advisors perhaps not telling him the full truth, giving him a rosier version of reality. First of all, does that make sense to you? And if it does, do you think that that problem, this echo chamber problem, is being acknowledged by the Russian leaders?
So I think the echo chamber problem was really formative in the lead up to this operation because it's very clear they thought that they were not going to meet much resistance at all. And I think that does square with the idea that Russian intelligence services would not be telling Putin anything other than what he wanted to hear. That being said, though, I mean, Putin clearly knows he doesn't control Kyiv. He doesn't control Kharkiv. So I think he's had a pretty rude awakening to the fact that he really didn't understand what he was getting into.
Hmm. You know, on the military front, as we watch what happens next, what military advantages do the Russians have?
So in the East, it is a different fight, and there are really three things to focus on. One is that the Russian logistics are more secure because they pass through separatist-held area into Russia. The logistics is simplified and a bit more protected. The second, with the appointment of General Dvornikov, their command and control is a little more succinct. It's simpler. It's probably more effective. And the third thing I would say is that, you know, that area is a smaller, more confined, contiguous geographic area, which makes it easier to concentrate combat power. But again, the thing that they're challenged with is that they have a force that's really taken on heavy casualties with low morale, and that might end up being determinative in all of this.
You mentioned the new commander here, General Dvornikov. U.S. officials say he was responsible for brutality against civilians and others in Syria in the past. What do we know about him and how he might direct this fight?
So he does have a lot of experience, and he was in Syria and was one of the main leaders there. But what I think is important to remember, you know, we've kind of labeled him a butcher, and I think that's correct, but he's not the only one, right? Commanders in Syria rotated through, and Russian brutality in Syria lasted the entire time that they've been there. This is more of a function of Russian military command in general and not just one individual. But I think that, you know, he does have significant combat experience, and if he's actually in charge and can bring units together, this might look more like a traditional Russian military operation than the kind of haphazard stuff we've seen so far.
I guess speaking of military operation, we have been watching Mariupol, the port city, so closely. And should we assume that the apparent Russian strategy there, surround and choke off cities, indiscriminately hit civilian targets, may be replicated in the East going forward? We also saw that in Syria.
Yes, I think that is the normal Russian approach to cities. I mean, it was true in Syria and it's been true in Ukraine. Mariupol in particular is part of that geographic strip that runs from Crimea into Russia. And so for the Russians to really control that portion of the East, that's really a key city for them to control. And I imagine any other city that resists will face similar types of just brutality and horrible like siege warfare tactics.
I want to ask you about the Russian ship, the Moskva, that the guided missile cruiser that sank in the Black Sea. Ukraine said it hit the ship with missiles. The United States supported that account. Russia says it was an unrelated fire. What do we know now about what happened and whether this is a significant moment?
So it is significant. I think we can be fairly confident that the Ukrainians were successful in hitting the Moskva with two Neptune anti-ship missiles, which are fairly new missiles that the Ukrainians themselves developed since 2014. The few pictures that we have of the Moskva clearly show a detonation on its left side that probably triggered a bigger explosion, you know, that ended up sinking the ship. It's significant not so much in that the Moskva was this incredibly militarily powerful ship, right? It had a hard time attacking targets on shore. It had some anti-aircraft capability, but it's the symbolic nature of the Moskva, the head of the Black Sea Fleet, you know, the role it played in naval diplomacy. And ironically, this is actually the ship that Gorbachev and his crew were on when they went for the Malta summit and the declaration of the end of the Cold War. And so there's a certain irony in the fact that it was the Moskva that sank.
Mm. Yeah, well, back in 91, was it?
Right.
And finally, as far as the role of the U.S. and other countries that are providing military support to the Ukrainian side, what's important to know, I guess, about the bolstering, the help coming from the U.S. and other countries?
I mean, I still think the West is providing what they need to provide to the Ukrainians. They could use more. I mean, in a certain sense, this is a different fight. And so things like tanks and helicopters and anti-aircraft platforms, those could all be used in this kind of fight. And javelins aren't just useful in cities. Javelins are also useful in the field, but it's also spring. And so you have a certain amount of concealment from vegetation that's growing. And so I think, you know, continuing to provide them with ammunition and these, especially the more advanced platforms, will definitely help them in the fight against the Russians.
Yeah. Jeffrey Edmonds is a Russian military analyst at CNA, a think tank here in Washington. Jeffrey, thanks for the time.
Thanks so much for having me.
By fall, there could be a new type of COVID-19 booster shot that would target more than one strain of the disease. And preliminary data show the new Moderna shot produces more antibodies that can fight infection than the company's current booster. But there are still questions about the new shot, including whether those extra antibodies will be better at preventing serious infections and hospitalizations than the current vaccine. Matt Herper is covering the story for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Matt, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what is new and revolutionary about this new booster?
I don't know about revolutionary, but what's new is that this combines, instead of having just one strain of the virus or mRNA that makes the spike protein from one strain of the virus that the immune system recognizes, and then it has two, and it has the beta variant in addition to the original variant. And kind of the idea here is just like as your immune system is exposed to similar but slightly different viruses repeatedly, it gets better at fighting them off. That if you give the immune system two different SARS-CoV-2 strains, it'll be better at keeping you from getting COVID or severe COVID or being hospitalized from COVID. In this study, which had some pretty big limitations, but in this study, the antibody levels against all the strains we're worried about seemed higher, about twice as high. That should mean that it protects better. And Moderna has another vaccine that it's hoping will be a seasonal booster in the winter that combines Omicron and the original virus strain. And the study design there is more rigorous, so will give us some better data.
Okay, so you have brought up the specter of a seasonal booster, which I'm sure many people knew was coming, that we would be getting some form of COVID booster shot every year, just like the flu, right? I mean, that's not surprising.
We don't know that. There's actually a really big debate going on. And generally speaking, you can say that the public health community has generally been more skeptical of the need for boosting. And some people
really
like to think of the... We don't annually boost with a lot of vaccines. We do it with flu, partly because of the strain changes with flu. And the FDA just held a big meeting about how do we figure out what strains would be in an annual booster. The companies who've been right about a lot of this so far seem to think there will be a need for an annual booster. But
although
I think
they're incentivized, right? Because they want to sell an annual booster.
They are certainly incentivized, yes.
Okay, so I have so many questions here. Let's say that the decision comes down that we'll get an annual booster. Who decides which strains are included in that? For the flu, it's the WHO. Who would decide that for COVID?
The FDA wants a situation that's much like the situation we have for flu, where the WHO decides. The FDA committee they had earlier this month had all sorts of suggestions. One of the committee members who works at the NIH actually suggested, well, we need subcommittees to think about this. The recent booster decision for people over 50 was kind of made as an ad hoc emergency decision. They didn't even go to that committee, which they normally go to for these decisions. The easiest things to measure are antibody levels high, and do you prevent people from getting infected, which was the amazing result we got from the mRNA vaccines very early on. The hard thing to measure is, does it keep you out of the hospital? And are there these other parts of the immune system, like T cells, that are taking over and keeping you from getting really, really sick? So there's a debate going on about how much protection do you have and how long does it last? There's a real possibility, certainly, that there will be annual boosters, at least for some people. But there are also people in public health who say maybe they shouldn't be annual. There's a lot we don't know. And we also don't know how likely it's going to be that we're going to get another Omicron.
You mean how contagious it was?
Not just how contagious it was, but how different it was genetically from the previous strains.
Oh, I see.
You deal with one strain, then you get another strain that evolved from that. That one came out of left field. So the companies are certainly proceeding with an expectation that they want to develop seasonal boosters and that there will be additional boosters needed. But aside from the more cynical reason we just noted, which is true, they certainly don't want to end up in the position that we need boosters and they didn't develop them.
Which is fair. But who would end up making those boosters? Certainly when I go in for my flu shot, they don't ask me if I want either Pfizer or Moderna.
Well, that's partly because we know the flu shots are relatively interchangeable. I actually always check just because I want to know.
Oh, you do?
When I meet with a CEO, I want to tell him I got his flu shot. But
you're saying that we are getting Pfizer or Moderna flu shots. We just don't generally know.
Well, they're not Pfizer or Moderna, but they're not. They are manufactured by GlaxoSmithKline and Sanofi and big drug companies. There are a lot of manufacturers and they're interchangeable. And that's going to be one of the questions. Can you just kind of get whatever? That's an open question that's honestly pretty hard to study because these vaccines are not being compared directly against one another.
There's a lot that is unknown at this point. Stat News reporter Matt Herper will continue to give us the answers he has. He's been covering Moderna's development of a new booster that will target multiple variants. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Celeste Headlee in Bethesda, Maryland.
And I'm Scott Tong in Arlington, Virginia. It's Here and Now.